Welcome to Tracks Cultures. I'm Mike Piccinato, your host. This podcast unravels the intricacies of transitions across cultures. For those feeling the pull of change or supporting loved ones through it, this podcast is for you. We understand the uncertainty and excitement that come with such transitions, and together we'll explore how to adapt while maintaining community and belonging. Throughout our episodes, we'll draw on insights from the Cross-Cultural Transition Handbook by Dr. Stephen W. Jones. Whether you're moving to a new place or supporting someone who is, this podcast offers encouragement and connection. Enjoy the conversations as we navigate the challenges and joys of cross-cultural transitions together. So welcome back to a new episode of Tracks Cultures. For us, we're just recording right after last week's episode was recorded because we know that we have a short-term team coming and this is a time on our schedule that we can carve out to record. And maybe before we jump into the episode, especially because we're doing back-to-back episodes on some of the risk factors or the intensity factors, I have a feeling that this next episode is also not going to be an incredibly cheerful one. And so I thought maybe we would just start by saying, you guys have been here for a couple of weeks. What are some things you're really enjoying about being in Berlin?
Oh, I love this noodle place near our apartment.
Oh, it's called China.
Asia food, maybe.
Oh my gosh. These noodles.
The best noodles ever.
Is it like a little kiosk?
Yeah. Yeah. Tiny little spot. Kate went up and got some takeout. We did like a home date night.
Does it look kind of like a shipping container?
No. It's just a little white building with a red overhang roof, I think, right?
It has a few tables.
Says big text on it. Just says China food, I think. But
man, I love those noodles. In Berlin, I love getting those noodles so much.
Oh my gosh.
Like, it was like this incredible, Kate got this like chicken cutlet with these pan fried noodles that were just, it was just perfect. Nothing fancy about it. And then like a really good cup of tom kha gai, which is a Thai soup that I like.
Okay.
But they had like broccoli and...
Joel doesn't like green beans.
They put all sorts of funny stuff in it. But either way, yeah, so that was cool.
It's all going to be food related. I really enjoyed the ground beef that I picked up at the grocery store. It tasted like the ground beef of my youth and had less of the gooey process bits that I usually had in the ground beef in the States.
There's been a couple times where we've tasted things where it's like, oh, I remember things tasting like that at one point. Mm-hmm. Like I remember beef tasting like that in the past. I don't know if that was like exciting, but that was just very interesting.
It was really fun to explore a new neighborhood yesterday as well. I don't even know where we went, but...
On your bikes or walking with
walking.
The dogs?
Okay. Oh, not walking.
No, we just jumped on the train and we ended up, I think we were in Friedrichshain or something.
Okay. But,
that was fun. It was fun to walk around.
Wandering around, wandering into shops, looking at art. It was very cool.
My first couple of years in Berlin, like just wandering was one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah, it's been really cool. We're going out on like long walks with the dogs at night and the walking in general I really disliked being in the car so much back home. I didn't have a commute or anything, but just being out in the fresh air, walking and being able to look at my surroundings and enjoy things and take photographs and see
you guys have a beautiful neighborhood. I mean,
close
to a couple of lakes.
It doesn't feel like you're in a giant city at all.
Lake is being generous.
Small lake.
Yeah, it's a small lake. It looks like it might have some depth. I think that's why they get to call it a lake. But yeah, the area of it is not very big at all. But no, it's a lovely setting. But
bigger than a pond.
I don't know. I think the definition is like sunlight. For it to be a pond, sunlight has to be able to reach the bottom of the entire body. And I don't know if that's the case in Obersee. We'll see.
So the wandering and the food has been really fun. And the ease of public transportation. We're so not used to that. And that is so nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has been really cool. But it's also, that'll like switch your mood though too, when like everything needs to line up really nice and then you come around the corner and see your train pulling away.
Oh yeah.
And it's like knowing that it's going to be like 17 minutes.
Yeah, especially that one tram for you guys, the 27.
The 27, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That one's brutal.
That'll break your heart.
and possibly lead to marital conflict.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe it did.
Not between you, but
never.
I mean, for others.
For others.
Yeah.
And we've launched right into talking without me introducing. Joel is here with us again today, and Kate is here. And we also have the privilege of having Stephen Jones with us again.
Howdy.
So, Stephen, this week, what we want to talk about on the podcast episode is these factors that increase risk. And so last time we talked about factors that intensify the experience, and this time it's risk factors. Maybe introduce why these are factors that increase risk and then walk us through some of these different factors.
Yeah, these also originate with our Michael Page, who is at the University of Minnesota. And he was also involved with my master's program. Like, I see him around at the master's program. So, yeah, anyway. Sorry, I'm rereading my own book as we're doing this. I just saw that I recommend conducting a regular every 2 weeks or so review of both the intensity factors and the risk factors. And I'm like, oh, that's a great idea.
I'm so, a genius.
And that's something that all of us have done.
We are currently doing that right now.
Yeah. So in 2 weeks, should we do this again?
Yeah.
I feel like the intensity factors, if you think about where they're originating, they're a little bit more external. Mm-hmm. And the risk factors are a little bit more internal, if that makes sense. They're still brought about by being in a new environment, right? By the cross-cultural transition. But I think that where the core issue is feels a little bit more personal on the risk factors.
Personal as in these are things that are coming, as you said, from internal. So we're having to face issues that maybe are more key to who we are, or who we think we are.
Yeah, I think maybe to jump into that, I'll actually start with the second to last one, because it ties in so nicely with where we left off, with what you were talking about, Kate, at the end of the last episode. It's the risk of self-awareness and ways in which the cross-cultural transition can introduce elements of self-awareness that you're not necessarily, I don't know, that don't feel safe. Right. So you were asking this question of like, why do I value peace? Or what is that peace? Or, you know, what do I mean by peace? Those kinds of questions. And those like actually go really, really deep, really fast. Yeah. And the risk of discovering in yourself something that you're like, oh, I didn't think that was there. Like, I thought when I, you know, was trying to bring peace to myself and people around me that I was generally just a very nice person.
Right.
And like, maybe you discover something else in there. I'm not like, no accusations, but like, there's this risk, right, of discovering something in yourself that you're like, I didn't want that to be there. And because I'm in this intercultural experience, in this cross-cultural transition, I'm now having to ask questions about the world around me and about myself that actually are very risky.
Yeah. So I think with this one, what I think is, when I think of peace, I often think of this environment that I've controlled in such a way that I can feel at peace within the environment. And my environment is so much more out of my control now. And so that's been a real wrestling with me over the years. It's like that Anne Morrow Lindbergh quote that we have as one of the meditations for our daily prayer, where it's live from day to day, just from day to day. And I find that I don't do that well. Mm. And so peace for me is often control. And
I can see that for myself too.
I think there's also a sense in which so much of our sense of how to be good in the world is actually, we like offload that responsibility onto the people around us. Mm. And they help us to be good in certain ways and to understand ourselves as good. And sometimes we'll, like, there's a couple of risks that go with that in terms of self-awareness. One is, you might realize like, oh, my actual ability to control my own behavior is way less than I thought it was. Like, I thought I was the super self-disciplined person. I thought I was a generally good person. I'm a jerk, right? Or like, I have deeply unsolved problems, morally even, that were okay. They were managed in the environment. And then I find myself in an environment where it's like, oh, the environment is no longer supporting the management. Sometimes we talk about like a not great discipleship approach is sin management. And one of the reasons that it's not a great discipleship approach is that it's actually not transforming you, right? But like moving into another culture, you sometimes discover that. The other, oh man, I had two. Shoot, what was the other?
While you're thinking, one of the things that I find that is just such an indicator that I'm not where I should be yet is I become angry at a level that is not healthy at bike riders on the sidewalk who ring their bell at me.
if they're because they're not supposed to be there.
They're not supposed to be there
unless they have a kid with them. Yeah,
they're older than 10 years old. Adults that come by on the bikes behind me and ring their sidewalks because they don't want to ride on the cobblestones. And it's so easy for me to just step out of the way and let them go. But man, I get angry at them.
Do you like sometimes make yourself bigger?
No, but I do often think of that. I do often think of just like clotheslining them off their
Okay. I think that's worse. That's worse.
I don't do it, but
I feel very justified suddenly.
Yeah, you should. It's horrible.
Yeah, I've been wondering if what is peace? Is that lack of conflict? Is it lack of any sort of discomfort? And I just like know, and I'm like, I can hear like Jesus shouting at me is like, discipleship is not.
Sorry, wait. In your moment of peace, you hear Jesus shouting at you?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. That's how he speaks to me usually, because that's the only way I listen. Yeah, it's just discipleship is not easy, and not going into like huge detail about what Joel and I talked about this morning, but lack of peace has a lot to do with recent discipleship. And like, what am I looking for? Am I looking for ease? Well, that would mean removing the disciple, but that's not what God called us to do. Mm. And so what am I looking for? If I want peace, that would mean removing anybody that needs anything from me. And that's not what I want. Mm. And that's not what God wants for me. And so I have like just a lot of self-reflecting to do.
So you had peace back home and you still had plenty of people that needed you and
yes,
pushed you and stressed you out. And mm-hmm. It was possible.
It was. Yeah. So that is just like, I don't know what I'm looking for.
But it is different to be in a position where other people need you and to be in a position where you need other people. Mm. And
yeah.
I am less at peace when I need a lot of other people.
I am. I pride myself on not needing other people a lot. And so now that I do, that probably is adding mm-hmm. another layer of just discomfort, is because I am so dependent and I just really love not needing anybody else. Mm.
And yet, like, probably if you looked at your life in Omaha, like probably a lot of the ways in which you were comfortable being you were actually built on those social fabric, on that mm-hmm. social structure.
Yes.
And that's where that risk of that being removed, and then also having this active dependency on other people.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. There's just, I keep discovering new layers, and it's really good to have this team, well, to even just talk about it and just know that, one, I'm not alone. This isn't like completely out of left field, but man, how do I process that?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting with our participants, because we end up walking through these kinds of processes mm-hmm. with our participants a lot. And I think this risk of self-awareness is such a core thing. Sometimes the cross-cultural experience will reveal issues that you thought were resolved. Sometimes it's mental health issues. Sometimes it's relationship issues from the past. Sometimes it's, you know, even trauma, big or small T trauma, right, from the past. Sometimes it is, these moral issues. There's just all of these different things that get stirred up again. And I think maybe that was the other thing I was going to say. There's this issue of like your sin is managed or your goodness is managed mm-hmm. in before, right? And then that all gets disrupted. And then there's also this reality of like when you're under significant stress, sometimes you discover that like under pressure, what comes out is like, oh, that's just kind of ugly. Mm. Like there's something in me that's actually just kind of ugly. And I didn't think it was there. And so then it's not so much about behavior, but it's like, I have these deep wounds or these deep core, like, I don't even want to be good. Mm. Right. And then of course there are other theological questions like, okay, what are we supposed to do with goodness and badness? And is the pursuit of knowing goodness and badness actually the original sin, right? You know, like there's those kinds of issues, you know, like and then it gets into all these complicated things. But the entry point, I think, for a lot of us in that is recognizing like, okay, no, like actually I have hate in my heart mm. or I have, you know, whatever it is.
I'm deeply selfish. I don't care about people the way I thought I did.
And that's a different level of issue than just having your good behavior managed.
And our environment controls that to a degree that I think we are often unaware of, mm-hmm. Both rewarding and punishing behavior or selfishness. And when we find ourselves in a different environment that values those things differently, then the internal motivations are sometimes revealed in ways mm-hmm. that we are
yeah, I mean,
not loving.
Yeah, Yeah. Or ways in which like, you're like, oh, I really trust God. And then like you're put into a situation where you have to like actually ask the question, do I actually trust God? And you're like, yeah. Oh, actually I don't trust God at all. I trust myself mm-hmm. within certain parameters. I have no idea what it means to trust God. I thought I did. I thought this whole exercise of moving here was trusting God, but I didn't. I had not even actually started because it was still so safe.
Again, I'll go back to the car brands that we didn't know about. Just seeing that made me go, what?
You immediately said about the cars. You turned it into like, what don't I know about God?
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, it's terrifying.
But that's like absolutely the thing.
Yeah.
But that's risky, right?
Yeah. It's like I had my unawareness of car makers throw my belief in God up in the air for a minute. That's nuts.
So now we'll back off and go to something lighter.
Sweet.
Public and private boundaries are different in different cultures, and getting an understanding of like what is considered public space, what's considered private space, what are public conversations, what are private conversations, increases risk. Sometimes this is really minor. Like, it's really common here for people to ask how many square meters your apartment has and how much it costs. Mm-hmm. That's a super common question.
Okay.
I mean, we had people that came into our apartment for the first time, Germans, and they were fascinated by the size of our refrigerator and wanted to know how big it was and how expensive it was.
Sure.
So things like that would just kind of be like, oh, that's sort of private. I don't know. Like, why are you asking about that? And then there are other things that are private here, and I can't think of any examples.
I was going to ask for one, and that's, yeah.
Maybe something that's generally a public question in the U.S. that's more of a private or small group conversation is just, how are you?
Yeah,
like, you don't that's a great ask example. How are you in Germany unless you really mean it.
I remember there was an artist in residence, I remember years ago, that was talking about that same sentiment, like, people would say it was nice talking with you or something like, yeah, similar. And it would say like, we didn't talk. You don't know me. That was just, you were just making pleasantries while we were talking, like, but you don't actually know me. And we didn't really meet. We just talked at each other for a while.
And like the word friend is another one. It's much more reserved.
Yeah. It's a special thing.
Yeah. That's a good example. In some ways, the word friend is much more private here. Mm. And I don't mean private in the sense that it's a thing you don't say, but it's really reserved for a very particular type of relationship.
Yeah, it's a cherished
thing.
And
we throw it around, right? Like, it's a very public, like, and that has to do, there's this idea of different circles of relationship and how far out those are and what the boundaries of them are, and how permeable they are, that kind of thing.
But you'll find yourself really confusing people initially if you have met someone and you're introducing them to someone else and you say, hey, this is my friend. Because now all of a sudden they're wondering
they're like, you're my friend, but I'm not your friend.
And we've also had people we know get into trouble.
That did not land.
sorry, I was moving on. we had people who have gotten into trouble by calling people friend. And then not fulfilling the obligations of friendship and then ruining the relationship.
Oh, interesting.
Because we don't know what those obligations of friendship are, and it's a certain level of contact, daily contact, weekly contact.
And then there are all these other words that are really useful for describing people in those categories, right? So like a bekannte is somebody that you know, but aren't necessarily friends with, or Mitschüler, somebody you go to school with, or somebody you work with, right? There's all these specific words to describe those relationship types that don't necessarily imply friendship.
Mm. So this is my classmate, this is my colleague, this is my acquaintance.
My acquaintance, yeah.
And it would be so rude in the States to be like, this is my acquaintance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have but to, that, this is
that
my
word
friend.
Is much more private here.
Yeah.
And yeah.
If you're using it, it is communicating something both to that person and to the person that you're talking to about the level of relationship that you have with
basically
somebody.
You're stating how you feel about each other.
Another public private boundary that can kind of weird people out here coming from the States is like staring. So you kind of think of, okay, so there's this really interesting mix. I think I found one. So on the one hand, you have the right to your image, right? So like if I take a picture of you and I post it online and you say, no, that's my private image, then I have to take it down, right? Because I don't have the right to your image. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if we're on the tram, I can just stare at you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily an invasion of privacy or rude. Yeah. Or, and so there's this interesting flip-flop of what's private and public.
Yeah, I was thinking about that yesterday. I think back in the States, you could stare at someone enough to get charges pressed against you. Harassment or something, right? Yeah. Just it's funny.
Another difference in public and private here would be like this really interesting mix of public and private space on public transit, right? So on the one hand, it's a public space. It's shared. You're there with everybody else. And on the other hand, you should not be like imposing yourself into other people's private space.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I think recently there was an announcement about, you know, do you like TikToks? That's great. Don't share them with everybody, you know, like have headphones in, that kind of thing.
I heard that this morning on the train.
But this idea of how do you maintain other people's private space in what is clearly a very public space. And so even just the way that those things are navigated is different. Another is windows, you know, and like whose responsibility is it to maintain the boundary of a window? So like, you know, at night, if you have your lights on in your apartment and your window's open, people walking by can see into your apartment, right? Whose responsibility is that to maintain that boundary?
In the US, we would say that's the house owner's responsibility. You draw a curtain or something to make sure that people can't look in.
Yeah, and here it's the person walking by. Don't look in. If you don't, if you're offended by what you see looking in, don't look in. It's not your space. Keep looking. Yeah. But that person has the right to have their window open. Yeah. That's not their fault.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That dance of we do certain things for other people's comfort and we do certain things regardless of others' comfort. It does feel flipped on its head here a little bit.
I wondered if I crossed a line the other day. There was an older lady on the train and her bag bumped me and I thought she was tapping me so she could sit down. And so I jumped up and asked her to sit and we went to the back and forth of no. I was like, please, please, please. And she kept thanking me and I reached forward and like squeezed her shoulder and because that's what I would do anytime. And it was like totally fine. But then I panicked like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to touch people. What is that? And it ended up being totally fine. And she was incredibly kind. She was so cute. She had like...
I'll never forget the way she looked. Yeah, she had the full headscarf and everything on, but then gold teeth, like just awesome gold teeth. Older gal, like probably and, 60s.
Yeah. And so it was just like, but I was so cool. But I wondered, did I cross a line by like squeezing her shoulder? And she didn't care.
You'll just bump up into that all the time. Just this idea of, oh man, I just did something that's really natural for me. And I don't know what people here think of
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in some ways there's just this learning how to be yourself in a different culture. And also not insisting on always being yourself in a different culture. Remember, we had a conversation before about what is your authentic self?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I mean, you kind of discover this as you go, right? And not saying.
Yeah, yeah, I'm balancing that every day. And that was one of them, like, oh no, did I cross a line? And I didn't with her. So
I think this taps in really nicely to another one of the risk factors, which is the risk of embarrassment and offense.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the risk that you will be embarrassed for all sorts of reasons, and the risk that you will offend people or be offended, and that you don't know, that you just don't know, that I'm trying, right, to do it right. And of course, the more under pressure you are and the more under stress you are, the less able you are to try to do it well, or even sometimes the desire to do it well goes away a little bit. Like, I don't even care. I just, you know, yeah. But like, even when you're really trying, that you can absolutely get embarrassed. With language, it happens all the time where you'll be saying something. Sometimes it's minor. There was a guy who was asking about the weather my first year here because he was trying to figure out if it was safe to go because the bus was going to take like 20 minutes to get there or something like that. And so we were at a bus stop and he was asking about the weather. And I was like, yeah, I was answering him in German. I was like, yeah, you have to, like, it's fine. You just have to be careful because a person could smoke, because I said Rauschen instead of Rutschen.
Ah, slip.
Yeah. Instead of slip, I said smoke.
Oh. Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, that was embarrassing. It didn't really matter, but it was embarrassing. The guy looked at me like, I was crazy at first because I said something stupid, but there's just like things like that happen all the time. But sometimes those things that you say that are wrong are also like super awkward. Like that definitely happens too.
Oh yeah. We were encouraged to make mistakes and be embarrassed and you could laugh about it later. There was an international worker telling us all about, she said a major faux pas in front of children while she was trying to teach them. And she was like, they were laughing and horrified. And when she found out what she said, she was just horrified.
Like, I'm gonna get fired.
And now, like, years later, she laughs about it. And she's like, make mistakes. Just speak the language.
Mm-hmm. I about plowed into a guy on my bike. He had the crosswalk. And boy, he let me know.
Mm-hmm.
He was yelling at me through the whole walk across the crosswalk and everything. It's just like, it was so embarrassing.
And you know you're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
One pastor friend told me about, coming from the U.S., told me about the sermon he preached about whatever. He was working through the book of Revelation, and he preached about a giant strawberry instead of a giant earthquake because
amazing.
It was aired barren instead of aired babin.
Oh, that's funny.
No.
And if you can't be okay, if you can't be okay with being embarrassed, language learning is going to be so, so hard.
I feel like Carl's Ed Behoff would be interested in getting in on that.
That'd be a good one, yeah. Carl's Earthquake.
Yeah. Carl's Strawberries, now in Revelation. Another risk factor is the risk of failure. And so sometimes it's those small things that we're talking about that are embarrassing, but sometimes it's really big things, right? Like sometimes it's, am I going to fail my language test? Am I going to fail my driver's test? Because I failed my driver's license test my first time here.
Trick question. I will never take it.
But I failed it with an 89%, but still, you know.
That's insane.
Hurts my feelings.
But I think there are so many opportunities for failure. And some of those failures are like really risky. Like, what if I fail at being an international worker sent mm-hmm. by my organization? Mm-hmm. Like, we have the unique opportunity to be a very visible failure because, you know, we've asked a lot of people to be involved in our journeys here. The threat that comes with that, the risk is really, really big.
Yes.
I think one of those biggest risks are how we're defining success and maybe how our teammates are actually defining success or how our organization is actually defining success. But it's so hard for us to park our own definition. And so things that we might say are normal.
Like failing a language test.
Yeah. You might say, oh, this is a failure and I'm going to have to go home now.
And we're like, okay, now you know what you need to work on.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's different for us because we came from the corporate world. Anytime that someone from the home office would say, hey, can you jump on a quick call? Joel and I immediately, like, the dread and panic of like, what did we do wrong?
That's how you get fired.
Yeah. That's just like a quick call means you're in
a quick conversation.
Would you prefer that we ask you to jump on a long call?
Yeah, because that means you need something from us at least, right?
Like we'd
if
get
you're just firing us, it's going to be quick.
In the call, but then Carrie would be like, oh, just checking in. I want to know how I could pray for you. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, I thought we were in trouble. And she's like, you've already been chosen. Stop thinking I'm going to fire you.
Yeah, I think that risk of failure, I feel like language is just such a core area for this. Like, as you're learning, there will be days that you will not want to speak German in front of us because you'll be afraid of being embarrassed or failing or whatever in front of us. And like, what I've come to realize is like, okay, yeah, I passed my test. Mike passed his test, but we make mistakes all the time. And I think that idea of like, what does failure look like, that sometimes in our attempt to avoid failure, we actually generate the failure we're trying to avoid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But the risk of failure, and this is where it connects to the risk factors, right? The risk of failure, however we're defining it, even if we're defining it wrongly, the risk of it makes the experience more difficult.
I think a part of this also comes with as you finish up your formal language school and there's more responsibilities that you're taking on for Envision Berlin. All of us are working in some way in areas that are outside of our core competencies. And so there are, like right now, we're having so many weird problems getting visas for our interns. And the majority of that responsibility lies outside of us. But I still feel like a failure when they're not getting those, their visas. So sometimes it's the weight you're carrying that's not even necessarily true, but it's still a failure in a system. In this case, one that I'm responsible for.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that the real trap is in trying to avoid it. That's where the trouble comes in. The failure is going to happen.
Yeah. And obviously, like, we want to try to, and this is where, you know, sometimes we'll talk about coping. I can't remember if we did already or not, but like, you want to try to for example, cope in ways that are less destructive. So they generate less unacceptable failure. So I think there are intentional ways that we can kind of direct things. But then there are other areas where it's like, no, maybe the issue is actually my self-perception as being competent is actually the problem. And I need to lean into being incompetent. And if I, and like the way to do that is by recognizing, like, okay, I have value even if I'm not competent.
That I'm learning that now at 42 years old, I'm learning that I can do things that I'm not already good at. My entire life has been, well, don't do anything unless you're going to be good at it because someone may see you or mock you or you may fail. And so I avoided anything that I wasn't already good at. And this whole process of coming here has been like, oh no, I'm going to be bad at stuff and people are going to see me be bad at stuff. And how am I going to deal with that? And that's still going to take me a long time. So if you guys make fun of me when I say the wrong thing, I'll probably cry and it'll be your fault.
My buddy Dan says that failing isn't just for failures. It's for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting because like the culture that we're coming from in the US, on the one hand, you have this idea of like fail fast, fail forward, right? So there are some positive ideas there. But then like, man, if you go to like youth sports events in the US, the tolerance for failure is very, very low.
I used to go to wrestling tournaments with my mentee back home and oh my gosh, the pressure on those kids.
Yeah. And what that does in terms of identity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is really, really awful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think for us in particular, coming from our home culture, there is a lot of unlearning that we have to do around this idea of like, okay, what does it mean when I fail? And recognizing like, okay, well, you're still our colleague, right? Or you're still our friend, or like God still loves you, or you're still, right? That it's not this immediate rejection. But a lot of times the first layer of rejection that I have to deal with is of ourselves.
Mm.
Yeah. Do I believe that or not? Do I believe that God still loves me if I fail? Right. And that is a lot of times no.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You find out how you're really measuring yourself.
Yeah.
I think part of that is also coming to terms with this idea that, yes, on the one hand, Joel, you have to just understand that failure is going to happen and it's just part of life here. And so embrace the idea that failure will happen. But on the other hand, sometimes those failures have really high costs too. Mm-hmm. And so we also can't have all right, well, let's just discover our next failure. And so that's sometimes where it hurts the most is the amount of work and the amount of money we've spent trying to get a system that works well for our interns. And when that doesn't work, that failure feels even worse.
Mm, yeah. Sometimes there's also things where like, so I don't know if I technically fell for a scam, but I definitely felt like I fell for a scam. And it was this whole thing with, you'll probably get people knocking at your door, trying to get you to upgrade to fiber optic. And like, it was this whole thing. At the end of that experience, which was a terrible experience and I hated it, although I was proud of myself for doing it in German, which may have also been part of the problem. I got to the end of it and I was like, oh, I made a mistake. I did this wrong. I did not want to sign that contract. And actually the contract they had sent me wasn't what the guy had represented. And I was like, okay, I should not have signed that. I did that wrong. Mm. Admitting that to myself was really important because I had a certain amount of days where I could exercise what's called a Widerruf, where I could recall the contract.
Basically say,
I no longer agree to what I agreed to and there's no consequence for it. And if I avoided recognizing my failure, then I would be in that contract, right? I'm really glad for the Widerruf opportunity. But yeah, I think there are things like that too, where facing into the things you've done wrong and trying to find ways forward with them really quickly can be really important. And sometimes the avoidance of recognizing those failures can cause knock-on consequences that are pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
So another risk factor, and this connects closely, is role deprivation. So you're both competent adults who have worked, right?
Yeah.
Like you're competent professionals. You're competent. You know, okay, like at a basic level, you know how to go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And buy food.
We thought we did.
You know how to pay rent. You know how to do internet, right? And like as you're in this space, a lot of those competencies, at least temporarily, go away.
Very much so.
And that experience of being able to define yourself as a competent adult or as a funny person or as a competent professional or as somebody who knows how to interact with artists, yeah. Right? Like
those that guy, some things. Guy that doesn't cry.
is that a high value for you?
Yeah.
That sounds very Nebraska.
I'm like the guy that doesn't cry, yeah. You know? Yeah. That's who I am.
That those roles at least temporarily get taken from us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that risk is really significant.
Yeah. So much of my, my personality is in like those roles, and I'm not going to be the good listener and good friend here because I can't speak the language and I can't understand it. And the one with all the answers and the person that people go to for answers, that's not going to be me for a long time. So I get to find out who I am here, because that's who I was in Omaha is not who I am here. And it just, because I can't be. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to find out who I am in this season of life.
One of the big challenges that we see is that sometimes people will try to recover that sense of who they were, and they'll move too quickly to jump into activity that recovers that sense of who I was.
Do you mean like trying to get back to where they were, or just finding some sense of belonging again too quickly?
Either way. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll even define it for myself. Like I was eager to discover how I could be a pastor here.
Sure.
Because that's what I did there. And that was defined in a certain way, and God had a completely different plan. I mean, since I've been here, I've not pastored the way I did in the U.S. It's been 13 years.
But like could have in your first term, you could have started an international church. I mean, I don't know what your team would have let you do, but like you could have like created an environment where you could practice in a way that felt familiar to what you'd done before, but would not necessarily have been the right thing.
Sure. Sure. And I think eventually my team would have let my team was good or bad, however you want to describe it, but they were very consistent in saying you may not step into some of those positions that feel comfortable for you until you've gotten more language and cultural understanding. Mm-hmm. And that was really important for the process. But in my mind, I was defining arriving as taking on the same responsibilities I had in the U.S. in a different cultural setting.
Sure.
And so I think that's one of the dangers that we've seen with a lot of people, is just this idea of I'll know I'll have made it when I can do the same things here that I did in the US. And the question of, well, God, what do you want me to do in this new setting? Or what do my gifts look like in a different setting, in a different role, is really hard because it's a level of disruption. It feels super risky because of our identity in what we did before. And the idea that that role may not come back means sometimes for people, it's like, well, I don't even know who I'll be then.
Yeah. That's encouraging in the way of, I feel like the last few years, God's been peeling back a lot of our identity and just with work. I'll focus mostly on work, and especially in Joel's working, like going from a high-end gallery to the corporate world to the county jail. And yeah, you had to relearn identity and what you're good at, what you're doing. And yeah, so that's been interesting watching that and hearing that. It's like, you don't have expectations like that, I don't think. Maybe you do.
Now that, you mean here?
Here.
I think they're definitely lower than they could be, for sure. And not like I like low expectations, so just holding this pretty open-handed. Yeah, I've multiple times in my life, in my adult life, I've had my rootedness in what I do shaken when what I do is taken away from me in one way or another. And so, yeah, like the idea of going slow and figuring out what I'm here to do rather than trying to figure out how to do what I'm good at or what I already do. Yeah. I think the last couple of years has been very formative in getting me ready to just keep my mouth shut and sit and wait to see what's coming up, rather than force, you know, myself into a situation that at the moment I don't necessarily belong. You know, I just need to kind of sit on the bench for a minute.
And at the same time, we've hired both of you with certain things in mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we were hoping that you can help with and be involved in. And so I think there's a funny balance there. But yeah, for me, often it was those, not just what the team was asking for, but my own internal measurements of role and arrival and success.
Especially when you are wrestling with things like, oh, I'm not having the progress in language that I wanted to today. Like when that's your primary activity is language learning, and you're like, I don't know if I like, do I know anything?
Yeah.
Or you're like, I've been at this for 6 months And I can't say really basic things still because the grammar still is confusing and doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, like my primary activity right now, I'm not even very good at. And I'm not doing any of the things that I used to do. And that's where I think that role deprivation kind of gets this, I don't know, exponential level of discomfort.
And I think in both of our cases, Stephen, where words were such a huge part of what we did, that to not have a command of language is really,
The last one is cultural identity, the risk to your cultural identity. And sometimes this one is confusing, especially if you come from a cultural context where people think of themselves primarily as individuals, not as part of a culture, which is part of the culture of dominant culture, US. And so like you may or may not come with a strong sense of, oh yeah, I'm an American, or oh yeah, I'm a white middle class American, or whatever that specific cultural identifier would be for you. So there's partially the self-awareness risk of being like, oh, actually, there's all sorts of stuff that about me that I thought was me that's actually just my culture. Mm. And I don't even know if I like that or not. And then there's other stuff where it's like, oh, no, that's my culture. And now I have to renegotiate it. Maybe people where I am don't like my culture. Or maybe they don't understand it. Or maybe there are things about the culture here that I actually like. Oh, I kind of like this, and I need to figure out how to relate to this new culture, and where do I fit, and what's my cultural identity here?
Yeah.
When do I get to say in some way that I'm from here? Is that available? Is there any category that fits for that I get to walk into? And when I do, what does that mean for my cultural identity back home? And so that whole thing, what is my cultural identity, is another risk factor.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what is, well, and yeah, I think about that, like you've been here for 4 years, right? Where do you say you're from?
Wow. That was a problem before, because I'm a third culture kid.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Still. Ich komme aus Amerika.
Yeah. Yeah.
There will be other identity pieces that are a part of that, though, identity pieces that maybe you're not, like if you identify yourself as a gallerist or as an artist, you may not know what the cultural understanding of that definition is. And so sometimes you find yourself identifying as something and you're not aware of what that carries. Like me introducing myself as a pastor is a specific theological training in Germany. And that's different, not identical, not one-to-one identical with what that is in the US. If I identify myself as a pfarrer, that means I'm responsible for a specific parish. We don't even have that definition in the US. And one of the guys at the market I go to every week likes to yell out and greet me, hello, Herr Prediger, hello, Mr. Preacher, which is a different cultural identity. And so sometimes—
And also awkward, because like, how often are you preaching?
Yeah, I'm not, right? And so very rarely. And so those are some of those things where these cultural identities end up mixing with, well, how do I want people here to know me? And how do I understand myself in that?
For me, I got my doctorate finished as we moved here, right? And so I'm not actually used to people calling me doctor in the US, because I wasn't. Like I graduated after we moved here, I think like 2 weeks after we moved here.
Nice.
So to call yourself doctor is different than earning a doctorate. There are doctorates you can earn and not call yourself doctor here. I had to get my education evaluated by an agency here. And finally it came back and like, yes, the education I have, I can call myself doctor here. But then I still don't actually know how to implement that, because I've turned in that paperwork, like with my visa, I turned in that paperwork. And I just looked yesterday at my profile with the German government, and it doesn't have my doctorate there. And so I'm like, do I have to go register that somewhere? Like, am I doing this wrong by using the title without... Like, I know it counts, but do I have to actually register? There's just weird things like that.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't call myself professor here, because I'm not a professor by German standards, even though I was a professor. I was called professor since 2009, I was called professor in the US, but I'm not a professor here because of what that means.
You don't have the tenure at a German university.
Yeah. So it's just interesting, like this distinction even in roles of like, what can you call yourself?
Yeah.
And there are settings, it's true in the US too, but there's a weight behind calling yourself a doctor here that carries a lot of cultural values. So there are certainly times when I was sending Stephen to represent us, like looking at your guys' apartment, where the introduction to the landlord after I had found the apartment online was, I would like to send the vice president of our organization here and to introduce him as Herr Dr. Stephen Jones carries a certain level
right.
of, oh, this person is trustworthy and reliable, where absolutely using that title has cultural advantages, where if I introduced somebody as, I'm going to send Dr. Jones to go look at the apartment for me in the U.S. might
even be weird
or pretentious, right?
Yeah. So like, why are you talking like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Joel always says your name, Dr. Jones, like they do in Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm, and so yeah. I never think of you as a medical doctor just because of that.
Because I say Dr. Jones.
I have a hat.
Yeah. Oh, do you?
Yeah. Nice. It was a gift from my former students when I graduated.
It's amazing.
Also a professor.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, thanks for walking us through those. Was that all six?
Yep, that was it.
And Joel and Kate, thanks for interacting.
We have discussed the entire range of risk that you will experience.
Good to know about it.
I feel prepared now. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
And you will suddenly find yourself reacting to them without even remembering necessarily the names. And so I don't know if every two weeks would be maybe a good exercise to go back and look over them and say, oh, that's what I'm experiencing. But where I see this as helpful for people who are transitioning across cultures is that there are not enough people that are talking about these risks before people go. And often once they're on the field, they're experiencing things, or once they're doing living in a different culture.
I think too, before you go, it's really hard to imagine that could be
for
real.
For sure.
So many people, as we were preparing to leave, they just say things like, oh, you'll be great. It'll be great. You'll be great. You'll figure it out.
Just be yourself.
Yeah, you'll figure it out. And it's like, I understand why they say that, but it's so not true. You know,
or they'll say things, it's going to be so great. You'll be able to like sit in a European cafe all the time.
Mm-hmm. You're like, are you going to pay for that?
Like, here's my Venmo.
Yeah, exactly. I did have one lady at church. She was like, I want to support you, but it's going to be like a cup of coffee support you. And I'm like, that sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Stephen, I'm really grateful for the time that you've spent helping us dig into this topic, because I think it's so invaluable for people as they're transitioning across cultures. And thank you for assembling the material from our Michael page and for adding your own thoughts and material to it. And it's been really helpful.
Yeah, for sure.
Bye.
Juicy. Thank you for joining us today on Trax Cultures. If you enjoyed our conversation and want to dive deeper, we invite you to join our community on Discord. It's a space for sharing experiences, asking questions, and connecting with others who are navigating similar journeys. See the link in our show notes to become part of our growing community. Your support means the world to us. And if you'd like to help us continue our work as a creative community looking for the meeting place of faith, art, and culture, consider becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/envisionberlin to find out how you can contribute. Until next time, keep embracing change and embodying transformative hope for humanity.
This podcast was produced by Envision Berlin in our studios located in Berlin, Germany. If you'd like to send us a note, feel free to send your email to podcast@envisionberlin.com. Thanks for listening.